You guys remember to turn it on. Okay, this is the...
Bridge is fading.
13th, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And I am somewhat discombobulated because...
Is that shirt sweater a maze?
No, it's an Egyptian pattern.
Okay.
Yeah.
Patty made it.
Wow.
Many years ago.
But that's not easy, by the way.
And she made me two of them. Knitted me two of them. This is the... as I was telling Gladys, the elasticity is kind of gone. I've worn it so much. The other one is in somewhat better shape. But the other one, I think it was the other one, she knitted when we were in Lawton, Oklahoma in August, July and August. She was under this pile of yarn and knitting a sweater. The temperature was 105 and all that. So, yes, that was definitely yeoman's work there. But anyway, I was going to say, I'm all discombobulated because, you know, when my classes start, I have zero spare time. And our computer died, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I spent all of yesterday, and I still haven't quite finished, you know, getting, really a much better computer. Much, much better. But just, you know, well, you know what I'm saying. It takes a while to get it all put, all the little pieces put together and transfer all the files, download the applications you need, make sure everything works properly. I haven't quite got it all done yet, but anyway, that's been consuming a lot of my time. Anyway, so I got that on my mind. I woke up this morning thinking about, okay, I got to do this and this and this. But I do have to teach Sunday school. So what we're talking about, of course, is the varieties of religious experience. And we covered the first three chapters 2 weeks ago, maybe. And then James makes two contrasts between two types of religion. So he makes two antithetical contrasts, and one of them we covered last week, which was what he calls the religion of healthy mindedness versus the sick soul. Basically, what you're talking about is optimistic versus pessimistic religion. It seems a little dated to me because all this discussion that he has of the religion of healthy mindedness, part of that is, I think, Christian Science. I once knew a Christian Scientist, but I don't think Christian Science is exactly in the forefront these days. It may have been, yeah, Jay.
Well, I think his exemplar of the healthy minded is Walt Whitman.
He does mention Whitman, yeah, that's true. The impression I get is that there are several, you know, somewhat similar movements. And the only one I'm really familiar with is the Christian Science movement, but this idea of mind over matter and so forth. Mm-hmm. He's certainly much more open to that of the two, to that end than the other end, which is, in his mind, the Hegelian, monistic, you know, and God, well, as I said last week, the for us at least, or for me, the paradigm instance of the other extreme is Al-Ghazali, where God is, you know, in control of every single thing, and that means that evil as well as good, of course, and that realization then, for James at least, makes that pessimistic. That's why it's pessimistic, because if God is really all there is and everything is somehow controlled by God, then that means evil as well as good is God's doing, and that's a pretty awful thought, that the controller of the universe is not good. You know, of course, we're supposed to say God is good, and Al-Ghazali doesn't have a problem with that. But anyway, we're not going to go there. My only point was to sort of just remind you what we were talking about last week. But the contrast that we're going to talk about this morning, the second contrast between two types of religion, is a return to the antithesis between an emotion-based religion and an intellect-based religion. And he, in what we have already covered, specifically chapter 3, he had already sort of set up his views on that. I thought, as a lead-in to what he says about that second contrast, I thought I would reread some of the stuff from chapter 3, because it is a continuation of that same theme. And I'll comment on it again in just a second, but let me just remind you by just rereading a little bit here. Hey, Reuben. Where do I stop? Oh, there it is. Oh, let me write your name down, though. I ran out of space on my roll thing, so...
Oh, no.
I'm just having to write names in. I'll have to print out another one, but that's one of the things I haven't done yet, is set up the printer. I was telling people my computer died, and I spent all of yesterday getting that set up again. Well, anyway, so back in chapter 3, we may now lay it down as certain that the distinctively religious sphere of experience the distinctively religious sphere of experience, many persons possess the objects of their belief not in the form of mere conceptions which their intellect accepts as true, but rather in the form of quasi-sensible realities directly apprehended. In other words, some form of mysticism, I guess, in the broad sense of the word. And then he goes on a little bit later. I'll reread this too. The opinion opposed to mysticism in philosophy is sometimes spoken of as rationalism. Rationalism insists that all our beliefs ought ultimately to find for themselves articulate grounds. Such grounds for rationalism must come from four things: definitely statable abstract principles, definite facts of sensation, definite hypotheses based on such facts, and definite inferences logically drawn. Vague impressions of something indefinable have no place in the rationalistic system, which on its positive side is surely a splendid and blah blah blah. Nevertheless, if we look at man's whole mental life as it exists on the life of men that lies in them apart from their learning and science, and that they universally, inwardly, and privately follow, we have to confess that the part of it which rationalism can give an account is relatively superficial. It is the part that has the prestige, certainly, because of we're able to verbalize it and critically assess it, and so forth and so on, so it's prestigious in that sense, but it doesn't play a big role. Not play a big role in religion. That's his point. Your whole subconscious life, your impulses, your faiths, your needs, your divinations have prepared the premises of which your consciousness now feels the weight of the result, and something in you absolutely knows that this result must be truer than any logic-chopping, rationalistic talk, however clever, that may contradict it. This inferiority of the rationalistic level in founding belief is just as manifest when rationalism argues for religion as when it argues against it. I mean, this is what I read a few weeks ago, that just reminding you of that general thrust that of James. You know, for James, it's very clear that religion is a matter of the heart and not a matter of the head, even though he's a philosopher and he's writing about it and so forth and so on. Clearly, reason for him has only a subordinate role to play, I guess we should say. You know, this is interesting. I mean, I was just thinking about this morning when I wasn't thinking about my computer, this is the great, you know, we're in the Romantic era, right? We're in the 19th century. And this is the great counterattack on the part of, you might say, the irrational against the Enlightenment, right? I mean, if you look at it in a very broad sense, the Enlightenment ultimately brought forth an enormous attack against religion. I mean, that is clearly what's going on. The Enlightenment elevates reason above everything else, and although you have your defenders, they were always trying to defend it from an intellectual perspective anyway, so they were basically accepting the premises that the critics, I mean, they all agreed on the same premises. The only question was, which side are you going to fall on? But the weight of the debate surely favored the anti-religious side. So you have people like David Hume, of course, mm-hmm. who was very skeptical of religion, and even posthumously his dialogues on natural religion was published, and that is an extended and very clever, actually, he's a pretty decent writer, critique mostly of the argument from design, but he also takes a few pot shots at the cosmological argument, for example, that God is the first cause. But anyway, and then Kant, most famously, in a lot of people's eyes, drove the final nail into the coffin in his Critique of Pure Reason by arguing that all proofs of the existence of God fall into three categories, and the third depends on the second depends on the first, and the first one is logically flawed. In saying what he said about the first, which is the ontological argument, Kant really establishes the foundations of modern symbolic logic, interestingly enough, even though symbolic logic has nothing to do with the existence of God. But Kant's insistence that the logic of existential existence is different from the logic of a predicate is really the origin of, in when you take logic, mathematical logic, existential propositions are symbolized completely differently from normal predicates, like this is purple or something like that. Purple is a normal predicate, but existence doesn't work the same way, and that's the problem with the ontological argument. Well, anyway, but in a lot of people's eyes, then Kant, and not just the existence of God either. I mean, Kant attacks the idea of the immortality of the soul, and argues that also is based on inadequate, let's say, reasoning. So anyway, in the eyes of a lot of people, Kant really smashed the whole idea of religious belief, and he himself didn't think clearly too much of religion. He thought that religion should really just be a matter of morals, and if people could transfer the kind of devotion they have to God from there to duty, the world would be a lot better place. And so the Methodist Church has taken that to heart, as I keep on saying, even though we don't think we have, we really have. At any rate, but then you have the counterattack. That's where I'm going with this. So, I mean, the Enlightenment is building up this anti-religious stance, at least in the major thinkers. But when you get to the Romantic era, part of what's going on there is the gigantic rejection of Enlightenment anti-religious reasoning. Interestingly, and this is really interesting, think of James in relation to Kierkegaard. That's why I was doing James, as I said on Rubin the other day. Several people really liked Kierkegaard when we did Kierkegaard, even though I don't care for him too much, but a lot of people really liked him, and so I thought, well, heck, William James is kind of similar. I think they really like James, so that's why we're doing James. But think of them in tandem. But what basically they both are doing is rejecting the fundamental premise of the Enlightenment, that reason is the final arbiter in what we ought to believe. If you think about it, that's really what they're doing, right? I mean, as I said, even the defenders of religion in the Enlightenment period accepted that fundamental premise. They just tried to argue that, well, if we're completely rational, that it's more rational to believe that God exists, and so forth and so on. But the counterattack in the 19th century is more fundamental, because they reject that fundamental premise. Basically, yeah, religion is irrational. You have a problem with that? That's basically what they're saying, right? Just kind of in your face. Yeah, we're not supposed to support anything on the basis of our intellectual faculties. It's a completely different animal from science, say. Kierkegaard, of course, can't stand the guy, but anyway, he extols this idea of believing for no reason at all, or even better, believing when when all the evidence is stacked up in the other direction. Like Abraham, right? His whole deal with Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, and he's a lion of faith because he's going against every fiber of his moral and intellectual self only because God has told him to sacrifice his son. Yeah.
Knight of faith?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Okay.
Yeah, is that what I said? I hope that's what I said, because that is what he says.
You said lion.
Oh, I did? Okay, well, I'm sure he would be happy with that, too. Yeah, but yes, right. He uses the phrase, light night of faith. Reminds me of the Taliban. It really does. Well, anyway. James is kind of, he's not as much in your face as Kierkegaard. But, stylistically, he's not. But he's saying something very similar, that religion, as I said, is a matter of the heart, not of the head, and the head doesn't really play much of a role at all, pro or con, right? And he says that people are just not going to pay attention to, which is certainly true. You could talk to your blue in the face. If somebody is a committed Christian, say, or Muslim, or what have you, they just won't listen, right? And I suppose, in a sense, right about that. Yeah, Tom?
I'd offer one difference. James was much more of a scientist or orientation than Kierkegaard.
That's certainly true.
Because if you're unsophisticated on science, then you can wave your hands about everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, in these lectures, James is up on current science.
Definitely. That is very true. Yes.
And so, for him, it is quite the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All this,
Yeah.
We have all those things about, matters of the heart, about how it reacts, even empirical evidence.
Sure.
So he's not a pure, it's not like he leapt completely from one side to the other.
That is true.
But it is a bit inconsistent.
Well,
to me, it's like he did rationalize his thought by saying this is not going to be rational, even though the rest of the world is.
Yeah, that's why I said he's not as much in your face as Kierkegaard, and he's not.
But he is still hand waving.
Yeah, yeah. Now at the end of this, it'll come out that he'll clarify exactly what the role the intellect has in all of this, and it will turn out to be when we're talking about religion as opposed to when we're talking religion. You know what I mean? The difference between trying to give an intellectual justification for theological doctrines as opposed to a second order, a thing where you're just talking about religion, such as The Varieties of Religious Experience, that very book, or the series of lectures. It really is, as you say, it's more like psychological, historical, sociological, I guess, investigation of religious phenomena.
So do you know what he would think about Jesus and miracles? Did he care? Did he assume they were true?
I don't think so.
Not that important because he's second order?
Yeah. But when he is first order, and remember there are little hints that we've encountered so far of first order William James, and the last thing we're going to talk about, the pluralistic universe, is first order. And so, and as I've said many times, when he is first order, he's basically a Neoplatonist. Yeah. So, the first order James is a Platonian. But he's not usually at the first order. He's usually on the second order because he's partly a psychologist, right? But anyway, but certainly, Tom, you're absolutely right. I mean, Kierkegaard and James are, there's certainly a difference there. But there's also a similarity in that they both agree that religion is not a matter of the intellect at all. And that's part, as I said, of the 19th century reaction against Enlightenment rejection of religion, which was totally based on reason. You wonder where the world is going. I wish I knew. Maybe I don't wish I knew. I just wonder. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. Anyway. Because I think...
You should maybe read Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now.
I don't know. Well, anyway. So James then would... And that distinction then between the heart and the head... His terms, at least in the titles of the two chapters that I'm going to read from, are mysticism versus philosophy. So, I mean, he's using the word mysticism in a broader sense, I think, than we usually use the word, sort of to cover a heart approach to religion. So that's broader than... But anyway, so I'm going to read you from the mysticism chapter, where he's going to set up certain... characteristics of the good psychologist that he is, right? Second order kind of guy. He's setting up these attributes of what the religion of the heart is like. So this is just a more detailed version of what I just read you from chapter 3. let's see now. I propose to you four marks which, when experience has them, may justify us in calling it, I guess, a religious approach, mysticism, for the purpose of the present lectures. In this way, we shall save verbal disputation and the recriminations that generally go therewith. Okay, number one, ineffability. The handiest of the marks by which I classify a state of mind as mystical is negative. The subject of it immediately says that it defies expression, that no adequate report of its contents can be given in words. Let me just pause for a second. I'm going to tell Marty Euler, who is on. I just see her name there, but I don't see her face. But I'm going to tell Marty that she...
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm going to tell Marty that I'm going to prove to her in a few weeks that she is a Wittgensteinian.
Well,
I am going to prove that. What I just read reminded me of that.
Will she resist?
No, she will be helpless.
Oh, I see.
But you'll see. You'll see what I mean. Because we'll probably finish up James. I don't know, end of the month maybe, or I don't know. Depends on how fast we go, which is usually slower than I think. But I'm going to do Wittgenstein. Who is also, weirdly, something of a romantic. And is, in some ways, kind of going down the same path. Well, anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. But anyway, we're talking about ineffability, though. That just reminded me of it. Can't put it in words. Can't put it into words. It follows from this that its quality must be directly experienced. It cannot be imparted or transferred to others, right? If it's ineffable, I mean, the way we transfer information, of course, is by talking. And if something is ineffable, then we can't do that, right? And this peculiarity, mystical states are more like states of feeling than states of intellect. Duh, we know that. We know where he's going, of course. No one can make clear to another who has never had a certain feeling in what the quality or worth of it consists. Yes and no. There have been a lot of well-known mystical poets. I'm thinking of people like Rumi, the Sufi. I think he was Persian. Sufism, for example, in Islam, is the mystical brand of Islam. And when mystics are skilled in articulating things, and they've tried to communicate what they have experienced, they certainly don't use abstract kind of scientific language, but they do write poetry. Mm-hmm. And James says you can't communicate what the experience. But really, I mean, you can't. But you, Rumi probably would say, "Well, wait, no, but you can sort of communicate what it's like. Read my poems, you know." So yes, that's why I said yes and no. It depends on how you think that communication happens, and why can't we communicate through poetry as well as through, you know, descriptive discourse. Obviously, he's confining what he's saying to descriptive discourse, but I'm not sure that's fair. One must have musical ears to know the value of a symphony. One must have been in love oneself to understand a lover's state of mind. Lacking the heart or ear, we cannot interpret the musician or the lover justly, and are even likely to consider him weak-minded or absurd. The mystic finds that most of us accord to his experiences an equally incompetent treatment. Anyway, but ineffability, then, is criterion number one. We are still going, right? Yeah, we're still okay. I'm paranoid about that thing. Number two, noetic quality. Although so similar to states of feeling, mystical states seem to those who experience them to be also states of knowledge. They are states of insight into depths of truth unplumbed by the discursive intellect. They are illuminations, revelations, full of significance and importance, all inarticulate though they remain. And as a rule, they carry with them a curious sense of authority for aftertime. So that's the second criterion. So the first one is you can't put it into words. Second one is, and yet it seems some sort of state of knowledge. It has a noetic quality, as he says. These two characters will entitle any state to be called mystical in the sense in which I use the word. Two other qualities are less sharply marked, but are usually found. These are transiency. Mystical states cannot be sustained for long, except in rare instances. Half an hour, or at most an hour or two, seems to be the limit beyond which they fade into the light of common day. Often, when faded, their quality can but imperfectly be reproduced in memory, but when they recur, it is recognized, and from one recurrence to another, it is susceptible of continuous development in what is felt as an inner richness and importance. I'm thinking about the Old Testament prophets. You know, some of that seems to fall under this category, right? I mean, they seem to be sort of ecstatic states in some sense, and I suppose, at least the good ones. Some are not so great. Some of the Old Testament prophets are, I don't know how they made it to the Bible, frankly. Nahum, Obadiah. But anyway, but some of the good ones are, you know, pretty good. Ezekiel, good guy. Isaiah, Amos, Habakkuk. I like Habakkuk. You should read Habakkuk. It's really short. I like him because he actually challenges God. You know, he doesn't see why things are fair in life, mm-hmm. which is a reasonable enough attitude, right? And he says to God, you know, why are you allowing this nonsense to go on, you know? But at the end, of course, he realizes that, well, God is God, and he's Habakkuk. So there is an imbalance there. But still, I like that kind of saucy attitude in a prophet. You know? Pretty good guy.
For all the good it did him.
Huh?
For all the good it did him.
Well, it means, though, that it's okay. I mean,
you mean God didn't strike him dead, or we would never hear a story.
No. But what I mean is the fact that it's in the Bible
should
mean that, from a theological perspective, it's not a bad thing.
It's not blasphemy
to question, God. Yes. important lesson, I think. Well, anyway. Passivity is number four. So we had ineffability, noetic quality, transiency, and now passivity. Although the oncoming of mystical states may be facilitated by preliminary voluntary operations, as by fixing the attention, say, or going through certain bodily performances, because of course some mystical, like the Hesychus of the Byzantine era, and also in common, I think, with certain Sufis, had certain, ritualistic practices that, though supposedly had the effect of at least opening one to the divine. Yes.
Do the whirling dervishes count?
Yeah, I would think so.
Are they Sufis?
Yeah, that's a branch of Sufism. Yeah, and that kind of thing. But it's not the only one.
The Shakers. The Shakers?
I don't know. Maybe. I'm not sure. Did they have certain
dancing
things that they...
That's where their name came from.
Okay.
Dancing.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Anyway, so... Preliminary voluntary operations, as by fixing the attention or going through certain bodily performances or other ways which manuals of mysticism prescribe. Yet when the characteristic sort of consciousness once has set in, the mystic feels as if his own will were in abeyance. And indeed sometimes as if he were grasped and held by a superior power. So that's this passivity idea. You know, it's not me. I just sat there and tried to keep my mind blank or something and waiting to see if anything would happen. And suddenly, you know, I was seized by this force. Can't explain it, you know, but there it is. This latter peculiarity connects mystical states with certain definite phenomena of secondary or alternative personality, such as prophetic speech, automatic writing, or the mediumistic trance. Of course, these were great areas of psychical research back in James's day, you know, the mediums and automatic writing and trying to communicate with the dead and the whole deal. When these latter conditions are well pronounced, however, there may be no recollection whatever of the phenomenon, and it may have no significance for the subject's usual inner life, to which, as it were, it makes a mere interruption. Mystical states, strictly so called, are never merely interruptive. Some memory of their current content, always remains, and a profound sense of their importance. They modify the inner life of the subject between the times of their recurrence. Sharp divisions in this region are, however, difficult to make, and we find all sorts of gradations and mixtures. But yeah, I mean, mystical states, maybe that's a fifth criterion, you know, are life-altering as well. Right? These four characteristics, he says, are sufficient to mark out a group of states of consciousness peculiar enough to deserve a special name and to call for careful study. Let it then be called the mystical group. So this is certainly not something that is intellectual in any way. The closest you come to intellect, I guess, is the noetic quality, but that's just a feeling that this is some great profound truth that I am privileged to in this state that I'm in, right? And I think it's broad enough to include not just the great, you know, like prophetic mysticism or the mystical states reported by the Sufis or the great mystics of the West, you know, the Catherine of Siena and you know, John of the Cross and those people. But I think it's broad enough to include what Wesley called, how did he put it? When he was at Galter's Gate, you know that story, right? He was at Galter's Gate and I guess somebody was preaching on Luther's something from Luther. I can't remember exactly what it was. And he felt his heart strangely warmed. Remember, you know that. Somebody tell me the verse of this. I mean, surely somebody remembers that. Right?
I've heard it. Yeah.
Sure. Yes? Whoever.
Yeah, I remember it.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't remember what this passage was it was being preached upon.
Yeah.
But heart was, strangely warm.
Yeah.
A big thing.
Exactly. And I think that that would count. Right? So, in other words, I think that James's characterization here is broad enough to include not just the, you know, the great mystical experiences reported by the, you know, the people who are usually, you know, classified as the great mystics, but things as I wouldn't say ordinary, that's the right word, but as humble as Wesley's feeling that his heart was strangely warm, or somebody who responds to an altar call, say, and has a come to Jesus moment or something like that. I mean, that's a sort of a small version of the same phenomenon, I think, you know. But it's certainly not intellectual, right? It's coming from here.
But Tom, these things can be claimed outside of religion too.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You can take mind-altering drugs, for example, let's say LSD or something.
Yeah.
Where you get people claim all these out-of-body and mystical experiences, right?
Yeah.
You know, hallucinogenic drugs.
That's true.
Or people go into this, well, certainly ineffability, mm-hmm. and this emotional state, like these mystical states,
yeah.
again, people can go into trances, or even communicating with medium.
Yeah, yeah.
You could say, oh, it's, you know, you're talking to some spirit in heaven, but it could just be you're talking to some, you know, something like there's Auntie M in the crystal ball, you know? Mm-hmm. right? So that these aren't necessarily religious related.
No, not necessarily, but yes and no, maybe I should say. That maybe goes back to the discussion we had the other day, 2 weeks ago maybe, when we were talking about his definition of religion, and I raised the question whether it's broad enough to include things like, oh, I don't know, somebody who's a committed Marxist, say, but it's emotionally committed, I mean, in other words, to a political program or whatever. Would that count as religious? So maybe the answer is it is religious in a very, very broad sense, you know.
Yeah, like I have a vision of Lenin telling me what to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, or I read Das Kapital, and my heart is strangely warmed. Maybe. I knew some Marxists back when I was in graduate school, and that's probably how they reacted, for all I know. So, but, you know, remember his definition of religion is maybe he wasn't intending it as broad as it sounds to us. But anyway, let's see. Let me read you another little. This is another sort of a codicil, I guess, to what we've been talking about. The fact is, he says that the mystical feeling of enlargement, union, and emancipation has no specific intellectual content whatever of its own. It is capable of forming matrimonial alliances with material furnished by the most diverse philosophies and theologies, provided only that they can find a place in their framework for its peculiar emotional mood. So in other words, you could be a Platonist, you could be an Aristotelian, you could be a Stoic, you could be maybe a Kantian even, and I don't know if you can be an Epicurean, I may be stretching it, but in other words, you can, if there's a little niche in your worldview that allows for this kind of feeling that is characteristic of mysticism, it's compatible, in other words, with a lot of different worldviews. That's his point here, because it doesn't have that much intellectual content. It's kind of related to the fact that it's not intellectual. You know. Okay, well, that's the heart. Now, what does he have to say about the head? And that's under the title of philosophy. So we have the other kind of religion. You know, of these antitheses that he sets up, right, he's much more, last week's antithesis, he's much more sympathetic to the optimistic than the pessimistic religion. This week, he's much more sympathetic to the emotional than the intellectual version of religion. pretty obvious. To develop a now this is under philosophy. To develop a thought's meaning, we need to only determine what conduct. The old pragmatist comes out here. What conduct it is fitted to produce? That conduct is for us its sole significance, and the tangible fact at the root of all our thought distinctions is that there is no one of them so fine as to consist in anything but a possible difference of practice. Not surprising. This is about at least the 100th time we've heard that sort of thing. To attain perfect clearness in our thoughts, this sounds like purse here, to attain, you know, how to think, make our ideas clear. To attain perfect clearness in our thoughts of an object, we need then only consider what sensations, immediate or remote, we are conceivably to expect from it, and what conduct we must prepare in case the object should be true. Our conception of those practical consequences is for us the whole of our conception of the object, so far as that conception has positive significance at all. That's Charles Sanders Peirce speaking through William James's mouth. If, namely, we apply the principle of pragmatism to God's metaphysical attributes, strictly so called, as distinguished from his moral attributes, I think that even were we forced by coercive logic to believe them, we should still have to confess them to be destitute of all intelligible significance. Ultimately, that goes back, of course, to the idea that religion basically is a matter of the heart. And all these attempts to deduce, like in Thomas Aquinas, you know, God has to be this way, this way, this way, you know, you're just not going to persuade many people of that. Okay. So, not surprising, in all sad sincerity, I think we must conclude that the attempt to demonstrate by purely intellectual processes the truth of the deliverances of direct religious experience is absolutely hopeless. Okay. Well, given where we've been going, that assertion shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody, right? The whole thing is completely... So then the question is, and this is what I was alluding to when I answered Tom's question of a few minutes ago. Well, what do we do intellectually? Does the intellect have no role whatsoever to play on anything having to do with religion? Mm-hmm. No. It would be unfair to philosophy, however, to leave her under this negative sentence. Let me close, then, by briefly enumerating what she can do for religion. If she will abandon metaphysics and deduction for criticism and induction, and frankly transform herself from theology into a science of religion, then she can make herself enormously useful. So that's the first order, second order distinction I made a minute ago, right? So yes, the intellect has no role to play, basically, at a first order level. Don't try to prove the existence of God. Don't try to argue that God must have attributes A, B, and C. Don't try to prove the immortality of the soul. Don't try to disprove the existence of God or the immortality. None of this is going to have any impact whatsoever because of what Kierkegaard observed, you know, religion is a matter of the heart. However, we can scientifically examine the varieties of religious experience. We can examine the phenomenon of religion and talk a lot about it, as I have been doing, he says. You know, for example, ticking off those characteristics of mysticism, and next week we're going to talk about conversion, and we're going to talk about saintliness. You know, those are religious sorts of phenomena. We can investigate those as psychologists, as scientists. The intellect has a role to play, but it's a second-order role and not a first-order role, and we got to keep those rigorously separate. So he says.
Mm-hmm. So he's making a rational argument not to be rational.
At a first level. Yeah. He's just saying.
Because it's really irrational. His speech, his lecture is a rational argument.
Oh, yeah. But
don't apply this my kind of thinking to that subject.
At a first level, but yeah. We can talk about it at a second level. And his argument, by the way, is from the second level. It's observing, really, that you can talk to your blue in the face and you're not going to have any effect. There's going to be no practical effect on somebody who's committed one way or the other So what are you doing, right? So we're out. Well, actually, not quite out of time. Does anybody have any other comments or questions or anything? Because I'm not going to start talking about conversion in 2 minutes. So then next week we'll look at conversion. We'll probably get to conversion and saintliness, which are just related religious phenomena. And then after that, we'll turn to the last topic in varieties of religious experience, which is but he can't resist saying something on the first order level, and that's where you get into what I call his Neoplatonism.
So it's not clear how much he's interested in those first order problems. Like I said, let's say the miracles, Jesus and miracles. Is he saying that you'll never figure that out, or is he saying he doesn't care?
Maybe both. I don't know exactly.
But you see how useful it is, though.
Yeah.
That's
That's right. That's where the pragmatism comes in.
To church because it is.
Yeah.
Is it a good effect? On
yeah, people? Yeah. Of course. You know how you react to these things and that sort of thing is all part of the mix in evaluating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, his first order views are so abstract and removed from these kind of pragmatic questions about the reality of miracles and stuff like that. We'll see that when we get to that point. Yeah. Anyway, we're now out of time. So, see you all next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Don.
Sure.
Hey, bye.
Oh, bye.
I want to know why.
Akbar the Great.
Right.
And Joda was his Hindu wife. There's a scene where there are some whirling dervishes.
Of course, you go down
and
there's
been whirling around.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the musical dances.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, of course.
Akbar gets up and starts whirling.
I see.
And then all of a sudden,
that's a colloquial term.
You know, it's like almost like fireworks, but not quite. The screen goes blank. You know, it's like the aesthetic manifold turning into the aesthetic continuum.
Right. The undifferentiated aesthetic.
Yes, the undifferentiated aesthetic continuum.
Yeah.
Everything is the same.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like you're the Atman.
Yeah.
Union,
right.
Oh, well. Sorry, I'm not at a help on that one.